Welcome to panel six. Our first speaker is Dr. Grace Khoury. Grace has just finished her doctorate in studies of J.R.R. Tolkien and his different iterations of the Silmarillion. And she's Oxford's very first doctoral recipient who studied J.R.R. Tolkien. And today she'll be talking about the influence of Norse myth and sagas on the writings of E.R. Eddison. So you'll give Grace your attention.
All right, thank you everyone for coming to this talk. I hope you enjoy it. Eric Rooker Eddison was born in Attle, Yorkshire, to solicitor Octavius Eddison and his wife Helen Louisa Rooker. As a fantasy author a decade older than his more widely read contemporaries, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, whose Inklings meetings he once graced in the early 1940s, his writings were published early enough to influence the more famous duo of Oxford Dons. By the time Tolkien published The Hobbit in 1937, Eddison had already put out two of his novels. As with Tolkien and Lewis, Old Norse literature, the myths and heroic, often fantastic sagas of medieval Iceland, influenced Eddison's fiction. Eddison began teaching himself Old Icelandic at Eton in the 1890s, as did Tolkien while at Birmingham's King Edward School almost two decades later. Eddison continued learning Norse after he went up to Trinity College, Oxford, to study classics, in which he achieved a second class degree in 1905. Tolkien also studied classics for the first 2 years of his degree before switching to the English school, as part of which he studied Scandinavian philology. However, unlike Tolkien and Lewis, Eddison's career would not be in academia but in the civil service. In 1906, he joined the Board of Trade, and in the same year, he became a member of the Viking Club, later renamed, as it remains today, the Viking Society of Northern Research. While too old for military service in World War II, Eddison, like Tolkien, served as an air raid warden. However, he was not untouched by that conflict's tragedy, as his son-in-law was a casualty. Eddison is most remembered for his heroic fantasy, starting with The Worm of Ouroboros, followed by the related Zimiambian trilogy, The Mistress of Mistresses, Fish Dinner and Memnon, and the posthumously published and incomplete The Mezentian Gate. Although Eddison's oeuvre represents a pastiche of classical, medieval, and Elizabethan influences, and more generally are markedly intertextual works, this talk will consider his amateur Old Norse scholarship, which leaves its traces on his epic fantasy novels. Old Norse myths and sagas were enormously popular in the Victorian and Edwardian periods and widely accessible through translations and adaptations in children's readers. Viking-themed novels, which more or less closely emulated the medieval sagas, were all the rage, a noted example being H. Rider Haggard's Eric Brighteyes. In one of his letters, Eddison recalls how he first took up Icelandic at 17 in what he describes as a saga madness. During the two-year period of 1900 and 1901, Eddison acquired a slew of translations, including George Webb Dasent's The Story of Bernt Njal from Brendu Njal's saga, and also a 1900 reprint of William Morris's and Erikur Magnusson's The Saga of Grettir the Strong, or Grettis saga, about the doomed anti-hero Grettir, who fights trolls and the undead. He also owned many editions in the Norse original and language textbooks like Henry Sweet's Icelandic Primer and Vikfjusson and York Powell's Icelandic Prose Reader. A few years after The Worm of Ouroboros, Eddison published Styrbjorn the Strong, expanding on a figure from Erbia saga, which he read in William Morris's translation. Although not a professional academic, in 1930, his translation of Eyl's saga, only the second rendering of that work into English, was published with Cambridge University Press. It opens with a historical and literary introduction and ends with a terminal essay on translation. It is presented in relatively archaic English, with at least one more faithful rendering from the Old Norse using the term bonders from the Old Norse plural bundr for farmers. Eddison corresponded with and received advice from several notable Norse scholars, like Bertha Philpotts, mistress of Girton College, Cambridge. In his book, Vikings and Victorians, Andrew Wan calls Edison a serious and imaginative Icelandicist. All this material provided an imaginative wellspring which became evident to other readers reading Edison's fiction. In 1922, H. Rider Haggard wrote Edison praising his work and recognizing the saga influence in The Worm of Ouroboros. C.S. Lewis wrote to Edison in 1942, using Elizabethan spelling and the Middle English word auchdor in his witty typescript letter, in which he recognized in Edison's writing, "the auctors in whom I perceive you to be very well versed, as William of Kelmscott, Snorri, Homer, and Thomas Brown Knight." Snorri Sturluson, a 13th century Icelandic chieftain, politician, and mythographer, compiled one of the two remaining sources of Norse mythology, the Prose Edda, while William of Kelmscott refers to William Morris, whose home was named Kelmscott Manor. Morris was a predecessor and literary inspiration who, like Edison, was also an amateur Norse scholar who translated sagas and wrote fantastic romances with northern elements. While not the predominant feature in Edison's fiction, Norse elements in his novels can range from decorative to more thematically significant instances. The Worm of Ouroboros is the most commonly read of Edison's four fantasy novels. It starts in our world in the early 20th century. In an article on Edison's translation of Eyjolf's saga, Professor Matthew Townend compares the novel's beginning to those of Norse sagas. Following the maður heitt X, man called X formula, examples of which are found in Edison's two saga translations. And so you see examples of that here. There was a man named Thorstein, man named Ulf, man named Lessingham. Lessingham's house has a special room in which he is met by a magical vehicle that travels through time and space and takes him to a fanciful rendering of Mercury, where he witnesses an ongoing war between the two super races, the warring demon lords of Lord Jus, Brandolf de Ha, and Goldri Blusko, against the witch lords of Carsi, led by their sorcerer King Goris XII and their allies. Edison's nomenclature, criticized by Tolkien as slipshod, is curiously childish, featuring realms like Pixie Land, Impland, and Goblin Land. The beings described can look more or less as what their names suggest. The demons have horns but are otherwise human in appearance. The pixies of this world are not diminutive, and the pixie lord La Farie seems like a figure from French medieval romance. The wider world depicted is like reading a Thomas Malory reimagining of Mercury, with a language and culture evocative of the Arthurian court dramas of England and France. Words like plaisances used in Chapter 8, or a reference to jousting in Chapter 9, and aristocratic women like the Lady Meverian and later Lady Presmyra all point to the strong influence of medieval chivalric literature. Yet the demon lords possess dragons of war, ships with dragon heads at the prow, as told in Chapter 8. References made to fetches of the dead, a type of spirit from the Norse sagas, which in the novel are remarked to be streaming up from Erebus, the underworld of Greek myth, shows Edison's interweaving of Norse and classical influences. The story pits the demon lords against the witch lords, whose sorcerer King Goris XII perhaps influenced Tolkien's witch king, the Lord of the Nazgul in The Lord of the Rings. King Goris summons the terrible worm of Ouroboros from the abyss to best his enemies, a monster more generally symbolic of the cyclical nature of warfare, as at the end of the novel, when the demons have defeated the lords of Witchland, they cannot abide to live without conflict, and are granted by the gods to reset time so they can fight their old foes all over again. Such a shocking conclusion is particularly striking in a work developed in the aftermath of the First World War, a conflict in which Edison was not a combatant, unlike his contemporaries Lewis and Tolkien. And yet it was oddly prescient about the future in the aftermath of what was later disproved concept of a war to end all wars. Some character names in the novel are of Norse derivation. King Erp of Elion, one of the allies of the witches, is from the Norse Erpr, the half-brother of the heroes Hamdir and Sorli in Hamdismal from the Poetic Edda. The goblin lord Gro, the duplicitous villain and counselor to King Goris, is also Norse in origin, a variant of Groa, meaning to grow, the name of a sorceress in Snorri's prose Edda. Lord Gro assists the sorcerer king in summoning the worm of Ouroboros, and more generally, in keeping with the sense of his name, can be said to grow mischief to one side or the other, and he changes sides a couple of times. In a 1957 letter, Tolkien saw the worm of Ouroboros as being corrupted by an evil and indeed silly philosophy, and was concerned that Edison was coming to admire more and more arrogance and cruelty. Yet Tolkien praises Edison's work for its sheer literary merit, while objecting to the characters. He makes an exception for Lord Gro. Tolkien may have been intrigued by the particularly fitting use of the Norse name in the context of the novel. An exception to the slipshod nomenclature, he protested, as well as that figure's moral complexity of having treachery mixed with some conscience. And just to conclude, we're going to fittingly end with the Norse apocalypse, as referenced in the end of one of his novels. It is perhaps fitting to conclude with his borrowing of Ragnarok, the Doom of the Gods, the penultimate chapter of Edison's second novel, Mistress of Mistresses, bears the title Enfleki Renna, or as he puts it, the wolf runs, borrowing the refrain from Völuspá in the poetic Edda, referring to the lupine son of the trickster god Loki. In Snorri's prose Edda, it is told how Fenrir is bound by the gods in a vain attempt to prevent their destruction and the wolf's role in it, which includes the slaying of Odin, the leader of the gods. Fenrir only agrees to be bound if the god Tyr, shown here, agrees to put his hand in the wolf's mouth as a pledge, so that if Fenrir is unable to loose himself from the final magical bond put on him by the gods or the Æsir, under the feint of testing his strength, he will bite off Tyr's hand, which is what happens. The refrain Enfleki Renna is the latter portion in the latter portion of the Völuspá, tells of the terrifying liberation of Fenrir and the end of most of the Norse gods. Edison uses this for the ending of his novel of court intrigues in Vinjambia, a nearby realm to the realm of the demons. Part of a wider cultural draw to the Norse apocalypse in the early and mid 20th century, which is something that I've looked at in my thesis as a historical trend. Like others, Edison used more or less apparent borrowings from Norse myth and sagas to help develop his invented worlds, but did so in a way that synthesized a variety of influences. So I just wanted to end by showing you a lovely hand-drawn genealogy from the Bodleian, where he, this is from an unpublished saga that's in the Bodleian, and he made a hand-drawn tree. And yes, a family tree. Thank you all for listening.